So we're continuing the parsha, and Chazal say from our parsha we're supposed to infer a very practical, simple point. And that's called beware of the butler. Meaning, if you're going to have a guy around your house doing the cleaning and the butlering, and your wife is going to have this readily available boyfriend, so then you have to beware of it. People are very easy about taking male cleaning help in their house, and it's wrong. Chazal say it is wrong to set up a situation where there's a guy who is frequently in the house. The Gemara says that one of the lessons we learned from Yosef and Potiphar's wife, if you recall, when we started the story, we said that Potiphar's wife was pious, right? So you have a pious guy and a very pious woman and an impropriety that happens. Something wrong is happening here. And Chazal say, if you keep bumping into the girls, so say, excuse me, no joking. Chazal say, if you're going to keep having that interaction where he is constantly in the house and she sees him again and again, and she wakes up in the morning and he's there, he goes to sleep at night and he's there, then you're setting them up for temptation. And here I want to address something that's going to be a little bit controversial, but you have to be aware of it. Rabbi Meir told his wife, you should know that women can be seduced. And his wife was phenomenal. His wife is quoted in the Talmud. His wife was a genius. Her name was Bruria. And his wife said, nah, women can't be seduced. And Rabbi Meir said, yeah, women can be seduced. Women have strengths. Women have weaknesses. Men have strengths. Men have weaknesses. One of women's weaknesses is that they can be seduced. And she said, nah, I could never be seduced. So Rabbi Meir made a mistake. Rabbi Meir asked the student, and he set up a student and taught him how to make advances towards his wife. And finally, the day came when Bruria succumbed, and Rabbi Meir was hiding in the closet, and the student did like Rabbi Meir taught him, and when the moment came and Bruria was ready to sin with the student, Rabbi Meir came out of the closet and said, you see? And Bruria went wild and committed suicide. Now, Rabbi Meir erred. Okay, he proved his point. Right?
And that should teach us something. I don't think he felt particularly good about it. But
it teaches us something. Meaning, a woman can be pious, a woman can be a genius. There are certain things you shouldn't set up. And Chazal warned us, don't have a man coming and cleaning the house. This isn't right. You want to be there? Fine. You want your wife to have a guy coming in every day and she sees him and it's not right. And I'm saying this because guys here sometimes take on jobs as cleaning help. And guys here, you'll be married. You have to be aware. Chazal told us to be careful. And when we speak about Yosef, we call him Yosef HaTzadik. We have to know that there are two opinions in the Talmud as to why Yosef came home that day. One opinion says he came home to do his accounting. He came home to look over the books. He needed to keep track of what was going on. The other opinion says he came home because he was as interested as she was. On that day he succumbed. So he walks into the house and she's all excited. No one's home. We can do what we want. And he's also excited. And then the moment of sin comes. And his father, who's been praying for him all these years, suddenly Yosef looks in the window and he thinks he sees his father staring at him. Now that's not the person you want to see when you're about to sin, right? Your dad's picking him through the window. So Yosef stops. He puts on the brakes. And Potiphar's wife says, what's wrong? Yosef says, no, I can't do this. What do you mean he can't do this? This is what we came for. And she wants to continue and he doesn't. 10 drops of seed came out of him. As he was running away, he was intent on sinning. And for those 10 drops of seed, he lost 10 tribes. Meaning that Yosef was supposed to become 12, just like the brothers were. Right? There were 12 brothers, and Yosef really had that potential to be an entity unto himself. Yosef becomes 2. And that's the verse says, Vatashev be'etan kashto. His bow was drawn And with tremendous strength, he pulled it back. So that's a clean terminology. When it says his bow was drawn, it means he was ready to shoot. It's a clean terminology. Vayafozu zo'e yadav. Yaakov says he spread out his hands. And our sages say that he held himself back. And the Medrash says that out of each finger came out one drop of seed, whatever that means. That deserves a broader discussion about what that means. But whatever it means that he also had weakness. So you have a great tzaddikas like Bruria. You have a great tzaddik like Yosef. You have a great tzaddik like Potiphar's wife, who was also a pious woman. She meant for good. She had proper intentions by improper means. But she felt that the future of the Jewish people was supposed to come through her. And there was a true element to that, as we will see later on in the story next week. So those are two things Chazal warned us about. So Yosef also was ready to sin, and we learn from here how careful we have to be, even pious people. So Yosef is thrown into jail, and again Yosef finds favor in the jailer's eyes, and he's put in charge. And we said this is the story of the Jew in exile. Like the Midrash says, the Jew in exile is like oil. You could pour water on it again and again, and it keeps floating to the top. And that's what you see happens with Yosef. And wherever we were exiled, you see every time we float to the top. That's been our history, yes.
Besides, he hasn't been thrown into a dungeon, yes. He's sent into the VIP prison.
Into the VIP prison. So someone asked that earlier today. I want to tell you a story. Okay? I have a very good friend. What?
As far as I understand, Potiphar knew what's going on. But he
right.
Do different.
Right. So that we discussed earlier. I have a very good friend who spent about a year and a half in prison. Okay? He was fighting against the expulsion from Gush Katif and Amona and who knows what else. And eventually they locked him up for a year and a half. So he spent his year and a half in prison learning. He finished Shas, I think, four times in prison or more. Really spent his whole day and night learning. And I would visit him when he was in jail. And after he came out, so we spoke many times. And he once said to me, he said, you should just know that spending one day in prison can harm a person psychologically. A person can walk out of prison after one day and not be the same person who walked in. Don't assume that people can walk into prison and out of prison and be the same person. Many people who have walked into jail walk out, and they are deeply scarred. So I was a little surprised hearing this from a guy who spent a year and a half and seems to have had a very successful year and a half in prison. So he said to me, I have friends. I have friends who spent much less time than me and could not get married ever since. And they were normal before they came in. And by the time they left and they spent, one spent 2 days, one spent a week, one spent a month, they came out, and they're shattered for life. So you wonder why, right? But he says that the situation where your freedom is taken from you, and you know at every given moment someone else can tell you what to do, meaning you're taken, and they make you realize and feel like you've become an animal. They're basically, they're going to tell you, go here, go there, get up, go to sleep, go to the bathroom, don't go to the bathroom, you could shower, you can't shower. Every second you're under someone else's control. I remember when he came out of jail, so the first day he was home, his mother gave him money and told him to go to the supermarket and buy some bread and milk. And he stood there in the room looking at the money and looking at her, and looking at the money and looking at her. And she says, why don't you go? And he says, where? And she says, no, I just told you, why, you could go and buy some bread and milk. And he stood there unable to move. He just stood there. Because after a year and a half of being told exactly what to do every minute, he wasn't prepared emotionally for this freedom where he could decide where he's going, how he's going, when he's coming back, how he's coming back. So when you speak about a VIP prison, we have to remember, prison is not VIP. You're right. Among the prisons, this was the Cadillac, right? This was the Lexus Infiniti, I don't know, Corvette, where we're holding today. But prison is still prison. Meaning the fact that you're being told what to do is hard. And he was there for 10 years. So they have a dream. The baker and the butler. And they're both thrown into jail. And our sages say, why were they both thrown into jail? Because everyone was talking. All of Egypt was buzzing with the word. Did you hear about this Hebrew slave? What a nut. His master takes such good care of him, and he tries cheating with the master's wife. Crazy. What a filthy Jew. And God covered up for Yosef. Now, I want us to realize what happened here. Yosef did what was right. Remember, temptation was staring him in the face, and he said, no, I won't. And then Yosef is thrown into jail. So now, what's Yosef supposed to think? God, I did what you wanted. And we like to think, if I do what's right, then life will be perfect, right? Doesn't seem that way. You see the Tanakh. Yosef did what was right. So he doesn't go with temptation. He doesn't go with his master's wife. And what happens next? He loses his position. Everyone's looking down at him. And he's in jail. Yeah.
Wait, but then that should be proof that it was not like didn't went home because of accounting or something like that.
Even if you say that way, he still did what was right. That's a giant. Young man of 19, he thinks his father, his brothers, everyone turned on him, and he stands up. And don't forget, there are two opinions in Chazal. And bottom line, he did what was right. So he had a moment of weakness, but he didn't follow through on it. He stood up and said, no, I'm not doing this.
Doing something that is right. We start with something that is not right.
Okay, you're saying according to that understanding. But you still got to contend with the other one. And this is a recurring theme we're seeing throughout the Tanakh. Avram does the Akedah, he does what's right, and his wife drops dead. Avram leaves to Canaan, he does what's right, and there's a famine. He loses all his wealth. Right? We've been following this trend throughout the Tanakh. You do what's right, and you think the outcome is going to be good, and boom! It's not what you expected at all. And this is one of the rules we have in Tanakh. Man likes to think he can corner God. I'm going to do what's right, and you're going to do what I want you to do. Look, I did it! I made Aliyah! So how come things aren't working out? How come they're not giving me my two debts? They're not giving me medical insurance? They're making me feel like I'm the worst criminal in the world? I did what was right!
But it says that the Torah stand and then the Shema, the prayer of the Shema. You love your God, He's going to give you great fields, He's going to make everything great.
It's yes, it says it on a nationalistic level, not on an individual level. It says, if as a people we will live up to our responsibility, then as a people we will have prosperous times. Correct. It doesn't say the individual. On the contrary, the individual has to contend with the fact that he will do what's right, and he won't always understand the way God's playing it. Look at Yosef. Does it get worse than that? Look at Avraham Avinu. He stands up for monotheism, so he's incarcerated. 12 years. Boom. Good deal. What?
Avraham's incarceration and Yosef's incarceration?
I'm unaware of one. I don't know.
So, is Shem silent the way he was in Avram's incarceration?
So here, that's interesting. The Medrash says, V'chol asher hu osa Hashem yatzlech biyado. He comes into Potiphar's house. Every second he's praying. He's talking to God. Which is an interesting point. Meaning, part of having God in our life is talking to Him. So Yosef doesn't look at life and say, where are you, God? He says, I know you're here, God. And this is, by the way, probably the hardest step in every trial we have. When things go bad, our tendency is to think, you left me. And so then we don't want to pray. We don't want to talk to God. And it takes a step, an internal switch. You got to say, no, I'm going to talk to God. I have a problem, so I'll talk to Him. And sometimes, the Medrash tells us, sometimes God gives us the problem specifically for that, so we'll talk to Him. But I can tell you personally, every time something serious comes up, I have to work on myself to talk to God about it. Because my first feeling is, He did it to me. I don't feel like talking to Him about it. It's like, you know.
Wait, doesn't that seem like a little like immature child?
Not the one talk to Him?
No, to like do something like bad to you in order that you need to talk to Him. It's like a baby that wants attention, so it takes a cup and throws it on the floor.
I don't know. I think that deserves a broader discussion.
Thursday night.
No, I think that needs a broader discussion. I think it's a part of the approach that Chazal taught us. That I would describe it differently. Meaning, I think that's not analogous. I think what it's analogous to is a king that's driving through the forest and he hears a maiden in distress being attacked by bandits. Save me, save me. So he charges in and he fights off all the bandits and he saves her. And then he brings her home. And then he sends word, he invites her to a party and she won't even let his messengers in. She won't even talk to him. So he tries a second time and a third time and she won't even talk to him. So finally he says, okay, if she won't talk to me, fine. He hires a group of bandits. He says, next time you see her out of the house, you guys come and start up. And then they come and start up and she, save me, save me. And he comes again and now suddenly she's willing to talk to him. So I think that's what we're similar to. Meaning it's not that that's like a baby. It's that we're like a baby. When we don't have problems, we don't talk to him. Or we talk to him, right? We show up to shul. And as we say, Aleinu l'shabeach, think about what we're saying. We should really give praise to the one who is master of the whole universe, right? That's what we're saying. Probably the most potent prayer, the most ancient prayer. We're saying this prayer as we look the other way. How many people are standing there focused? We should really give praise to the master of the whole universe. For He is the one that spread out the heavens. And as we say this, what are we doing? We're wrapping up our tefillin, waving to the guy, telling him have a great day, taking off the tallis. What are we doing? This is prayer. So I wouldn't say that's like being child. I'd say we're like being the child. Meaning, we take our relationship, and when we don't feel like we have an issue, it's like, forget it. It's like the kid who doesn't talk to his dad until he needs him. You know, I came home one Friday night. We were by my in-laws. It was, we were still a young couple. Not so young, okay. And I walk through the door and I tell one of the kids, good Shabbos. The kid ignores me and keeps playing. I try a second time, good Shabbos. And the kid ignores me and keeps playing. Okay, fine. Comes Kiddush. And he comes and asks me for a cup of Kiddush. And I said, no, you didn't tell me good Shabbos. If I don't exist, so don't talk to me about a cup of wine. So he walks away. He ignores me. Comes time for dessert. He shows up and he wants some dessert. And I say, no. So he says, why? I said, if I don't exist, you don't tell me good Shabbos. So then, there's what are you talking to me about dessert for? He walks away. I still don't exist. So my in-laws look at me and say, boy, you're being tough. I say, yeah. What, I only exist in order for when he wants me? You won't tell me good Shabbos? So, okay. I got to play it the other way too, right? So I'm saying there's... I wouldn't say that's called being a baby. I would say you have to deal with the baby. So sometimes you got to work on their system, right? Yeah. If I don't exist till he needs me, so I'll make him need me. That's okay. I think that it's you have to react to the players on the field. And being that us human beings tend to forget God till we need Him, so that's how it goes. Yeah.
But let's analyze why human beings go through a lane, wrap up the phone, say see you later. Why they forget God? Because it seems like it's a one-way relationship. We talk and we talk and we talk, but yet we don't get anything back. So what kind of relationship is that? I mean, we could talk about, oh, well, you just got to open your ears, you got to open your eyes. 2,500 years ago, God was talking back to them and saying, hey, you know, this is what I want. Now it's just like, read a book. So what kind of relationship is that? That's why people are not interested, because it's like, I talk, but you're trying to get something and you don't get anything out of it. So that seems like a relationship where you're talking to your other half and the other half is just not listening. So what's the point of even talking?
Okay. I think we should first begin with a joke, okay? Because you asked such a serious question, we have to start with some humor. They say that, why does a kala go to the kotel? There's a custom here in Jerusalem that the bride, before getting married, and very often on the way to the wedding, will stop in at the kotel, at the Western Wall, and pray, and then go to her wedding. So the joke goes, why does she go to the kotel and then go to the wedding? Because we want to get her used to talking to the wall. Right? That's the joke. So I never liked the joke, but your analogy certainly brings it home. So I think maybe before we address this question, let's take a step back and look at our parasha. So how are we to understand Yosef maintaining a relationship with God when it seems like God turned on him in every way? He's sold into slavery, he's sold into prostitution, he's doing what's right, and then he's thrown into the dungeon. What's going on here?
Well, we say that those people in those generations were so righteous, and we can't even begin to be on their level, and all the Tikvah Shvatim, and all the, you know, they're all righteous people and all that stuff, so he was on his level, but we're today, and we're, you know, in the 21st century, you know, it's different time, different people.
I understand, but I'm asking, let's at least understand first conceptually. What are we reading about here? I'm saying, what's going on by Yosef? If we're going to discuss it, let's try, let's see. There are many answers to the question you ask, because on different levels, different answers are correct. I just want to make sure I understand the question correctly. If I understood correctly, what you're saying is that you would expect that you walk into shul and you pray for a raise, and within a month you should have a raise in your salary. 2 months, fine.
No, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying we talk about a relationship with God, and I'm saying, We talk, and God wants us to talk to Him. And you're using the analogy of, you know, you only come to the Father when you need Him. You only come to God when you need Him. But the thing is, and you also brought up about Aleinu, like, why people rather to tefillin? Is that the way to talk to the Master Universe? Well, you know, maybe some people just want some communication back. They're not necessarily, you know, an exact say, hey, I want $1 million, and $1 million just shows up. But at least some sort of communication. Seems like it's a one-way street. We just keep talking and talking and talking, and, you know, it seems like, where's the response coming, you know?
What response do you want? That's what I'm asking.
Any response. I want to be able to have a dream and see 7 cows and whatever. You know, you get a bunch of small cows. I want something, you know?
What do you want, again?
A response back.
I'm saying, but, you know, I'll give you an example why I'm asking. True story. Guy was sitting at a red light, and he kept wondering, is there God, isn't there God, is there God, isn't there God? So finally he says, God, I'm shutting my eyes. If you're there when I open them, I want to see something. Okay? He opens his eyes, and in front of him says in big letters, G-O-D. Guaranteed overnight delivery. You know, they have these trucks, big G, big O, big D, God. Now, I'm asking you, what do you tell this guy? So the guy says, there are so many trucks like that out there, you know. I'm just asking, you know, one of the difficulties when we come to these discussions is, I say before we start, tell me what's your criterion, what do you want? I'm asking a simple question, you know. To stand there and say a blanket statement, I want to see a response. That's not fair, because then what might happen is you'll get that truck in front of you and you say, nah, that's not, you know, that's not good enough. Fine, I'm not saying it is. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying very often we make this request and we're not being very clear about what we mean by it. saying, so let's ask ourselves, what do we want? Meaning, what would be a legitimate response? I'm asking seriously. I'm not...
A voice other than your own saying, this is happening because you did X, Y, and Z.
Do you really think you could handle that? Realistically? Saying, would you be able to continue functioning? Or would you check yourself into...
Hearing voices.
I'm serious, I'm not joking.
I understand what he's saying, because you do talk and talk and talk, and all that's left for you to do is interpret what happens in your life.
Wait. Fine, I'm not arguing with that. In one second, I want to quote a piece that Rav Soloveitchik wrote about it. I want to expand on it, but... I want first for you guys to have clarity what you're asking. And then we can... I don't think it's fair because I could answer this on so many different fronts and I'm just not sure what you're asking. I'm seriously not sure what you're asking.
I'm just pointing out that there's a reason why during the Leinu people are saying the most important prayer and they're rushing to get out of there because you don't see God, you don't hear God, you don't touch God, you don't taste God. You know, any of this stuff, all this is a concept in your mind. So, and we're all always relying on our five senses, or is it four senses, I don't know.
What you just said is fantastic. The Magid Miduvna writes it, others write it, our Chassadikim, many write it, meaning you're right. We live a life where we react to our senses, and being that God is not easily accessible to the senses, like you're saying, it's conceptual, but with your senses, you can very easily say, I don't see him, I don't taste him. You know, I had a friend who was a philosopher. He's still a philosopher. We're just not so much friends anymore. We were once talking about God, and he said to me, God, what taste is it? You know, what flavor is God? So he was joking, but he meant to say what you're saying, you know. How am I supposed to sense him? Not with my taste, so with what? With my eyes? With my ears? But the truth is that the answer to that is twofold. I'm just not sure which side to begin in. Does anyone see, do we have Rav Soloveitchik Siddur here? Rav Soloveitchik, the OU Siddur with Rav Soloveitchik's commentary. He has a beautiful piece on Kabbalah's Shabbos. I also have it at home.
Maybe not over in the library, no?
Okay, I'll tell you what he says. I'll tell you the idea. I would have liked to quote you his wording. It's a great volume. That great volume. Okay. Rav Soloveitchik says, when we speak about God, we have a dual relationship with God. There are moments when it feels like God is standing right next to us, it's almost as if you can touch Him. There are moments that feel so clear, it seems obvious, it seems like He's right here. Then there are moments that seem so obscure, you could look up into the stars, into the sky, and you say, where is He? Rav Soloveitchik. He says, we constantly live with that duality. I would add to that. We're in the process of having a series that is not recorded. For once I could talk freely. We're in the process of having a series about the basics of Jewish faith. We had a series on this before, that's online. One of the things we discussed is what level of clarity can we attain when we speak about God? Imagine that you're walking and then you reach a point where there's a gap in the street, and the gap is a little bit wider than your shoe. Okay? So if you put your shoe in the gap, you could fall straight down 10,000 feet. But if you just extend your step a drop, you make it to the other side. It's not so dangerous. Okay? So you look at that gap and you say, gee, I could fall in there. Yeah, you could if you wanted to. But you could also cross over it, right? That gap is how far you can get with logic. Meaning, your logic can bring you to a point where the distance between where you're standing and 100% proof that everything is right and that God is there, there is a gap. Meaning, there will always be room for you to say, I fell in. There's never a point where you can close that gap and you can say it's 100%, no questions, it's proven, everything, that's it, leave me alone, everything's clear, goodbye. No. There will always be that gap, and there will always be that room where you can say, maybe I imagined it, maybe not, right? So you can attain a tremendous amount of clarity, and at the end of the day, you didn't cover that gap. You still have a choice, and you can always choose one way or the other way, but you do have a realization. I don't like using percentages, but you do have a realization that maybe you got 98% covered. So you'll say, but it's not 100%. Right? It's not. That's where you have free will. That's where a person has to decide. Am I going to accept it or not? And if he thinks about it logically, impartially, then a person will be able to attain the understanding as to why it makes sense to cross over that gap. But if a person approaches it with his desires, so then he doesn't want to cross over that gap. Because crossing over that gap would obligate him. And being that he can always say, but there's still that gap, so a person very often likes to take advantage of that. He says, he didn't prove it 100%, you proved it 98%. Fine, for that 2%, I'm not doing it. Ah, logically it would make sense to cross that gap, yeah, but if it's not 100%, and emotionally I don't want to, I'd have to change my life, I don't want to, so no. And that's why many people will walk away, or they'll cross the gap, and then they'll cross back. Don't want, of course I don't want, again, because on the short term, it's more fun living the other way. The long term, it's not, but in the short term, it definitely is, and it's definitely attracting. So we have our Chazon Ish class, where the Chazon Ish works out logically why, if you just look at the world, and that's the same idea as Rav Soloveitchik, you look at the order of the world, you see what's going on around you, sort of makes sense that there's a creator here, there's a plan, things didn't just happen randomly, there's some hand behind it all, etc. He works through that in Emunah U'Bitachon. But still, like the Chazon Ish writes in his very first chapter, we live our whole life with this internal feeling that it's not 100% clear, and I wish it were. The same is true, I think, for prayer. If it's true for the religion at large, I think in a microcosm it's also true for prayer, because it goes back to the same question. I said a pshat, which I don't think I saw written anywhere, but I think there's truth to it, that that's why we call it tefillah. Tefillah comes from the word palel, to clarify. Every time we stand up in prayer, we are clarifying what do I and don't I believe in. I remember I had a decade where I wasn't convinced there is a God, there isn't a God, Judaism is right or Judaism isn't. Okay, a decade is a long time to live in doubt. I had a lot of questions, I wasn't finding answers. I remember the hardship of going to daven. Really hard. And then I remember going to daven and not being too focused. Because, like, who am I talking to anyways, right? It's a hardship, right? But I think it goes hand in hand. And every time a person davens, part of what's happening is he's also clarifying to himself, what am I doing? If his prayer means anything. I'll grant you that there are plenty of people who are playing the game. They're living the lifestyle. They ain't thinking too much about what they're doing. It's very convenient. They're part of a community. This is where I was born. This is where I grew up. This is what I do. This is what the world does. Fine. If a person's not thinking and he was born into it, he has it pretty easy. Yeah, you go with the flow, roll with the punches. And then you find your leniencies where necessary. You find your local Orthodox rabbis with the plural S, so you know who to ask which question to. And life can be very convenient, right? And worst case scenario, you don't ask and you say, I wasn't sure, right? That's another good out. So I'm saying if we're just born, so then you're right. Go to any shul, okay, on any given day of the week. I'm going to tell you a little secret. You will see the same people walking in every day late. Now, if you ask them, they'll tell you every day there's a different reason. But every day they're showing up late. It's always the same people. And it doesn't matter which minyan or which time. I'll tell you another secret. Almost always they're leaving early. They're not just showing up late. It goes hand in hand. You'll see the same people showing up early, staying later, showing up early, staying till, and the same people showing up late, leaving early. Right? So, I understand why people can't connect to Aleinu. I'll tell you a little secret. Prayer is called work. Avodah shebalev. It's work. Because the first minute you walk into shul, what you see is a wall. Tired, you forced yourself out of bed, you still have to make that bus, you don't know if you're going to make breakfast, you got to take care of the kids. There's a whole life out there. What am I doing here standing with my feet together? Right? I got work to do, places to be. Okay? I'll tell you another secret. If you start your morning, if when you open your eyes, before you start doing anything, you say, Modeh ani lefanecha. Give thanks, I, before you, Melech, King. Notice you begin your morning with give thanks before you said I. Okay? Our problem is, when we open our eyes, what's ringing in our mind is the best part of waking up. Is Folgers in your cup, right? You guys, is this before your time, or is this commercial still around?
No.
It's not around. Okay, so when I was a kid, this was, you know that commercial, right? So you're waking up, and your first thought is for that Folgers in my cup, right? It's me. But if I wake up, and I open my eyes, and my morning begins with modeh, with giving thanks, And God is a part of my day, so then my shul is going to be different. But I agree with you that it's very easy to walk into shul. I said an analogy this Rosh Hashanah. I said, as we enter the 10 days of repentance, we have to ask ourselves, how many times did we walk into shul, and as we hung up our coat, we left our soul with it, only to be picked up as we left shul. But we spent the whole time we were there, and our soul was still at the door. Didn't have anything to do with what we did. I'll give you another example. People walk into shul and the whole davening, and their eyes are half closed and their motions all represent being very tired. You walk out into the hallway after davening. Look at how alive people are. The discussions, life, you know, the politics.
That makes sense because you're interacting with
them. Right, that's exactly what he's saying, and that's why I agree with him. That's when I feel like I'm talking to the wall, right? But if I'll stop and think for a minute, what am I doing and who am I talking before, then it's work. And again, we have ups and downs. You know, one of the things I do in shul is I try to be honest. That means that when they wait for me till I end Kriya Shema. So sometimes I end after everyone, but sometimes I end before everyone. Because I also sometimes have more kavana and less kavana. But I don't think I should be playing games. So when I end before everyone, I take a sefer and I wait for everyone else. Because that's part of prayer. Sometimes you can focus more, sometimes less. Sometimes you work harder, sometimes you work less. Sometimes you're walking into shul after a whole night where you're holding a baby. You're happy if you could get the words out of your mouth. Right? Okay, so say that. So now I'm going to play a game. I'm going to start davening slowly. No. My focus now is quick. Can't focus slow. But I agree with you. There are ups and downs, and it's hard, and it's work. And there are definitely times when you feel like you're talking to the wall. But I'll give you one more tip that helps make it work, which breaks up into two. If you show up to shul before davening, even 3 minutes, the whole shul experience is different. And if you stop before Shmona Esrei for a few seconds, it's not so expensive, 5 seconds, even if everyone else starts before you, and think what you're about to do, the Shmona Esrei plays itself out differently. But I agree with you that more often than not, we run into shul 3 minutes late instead of 3 minutes early. We're rushing through the words and we barely know what we're saying. And by the time we left shul, the last thing we thought about was God. There's a joke about a guy who comes to his friend and says, I had a dream last night. Two yeshiva guys. And the other guy says, yeah, and why does it bother you? And he says, I think God spoke to me. So the other guy says, really? Why would you dream about a thing like that? What does he have to do with your life? Right? And that can so easily happen. We could even be learning Gemara, but what does God have anything to do with this? And we could be in shul and, you know, you probably know a few jokes about this too, right? So at any rate, coming back here, I agree with you that a person can go through life and go through prayer and feel like he's talking to the wall. I think that if we're talking about expectations of the product of prayer, so that needs to be better defined. I think on an intellectual level, you could reach a point where you've understood it 98%. There's always going to be that 2% gap where you have to decide if you're taking that step or not. And if your question was different, then tell me, and well, I'll try to address it. Did I address it, or?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes also a question of how we're listening to what Hashem has to say to us. It's hard, but.
That's a tough one, because like the Chazon Ish writes, we're in the middle of reading it. Chazon Ish says there's a very fine line between intellect and imagination, and we like to imagine, and it's very hard to discern where you're crossing that line. I think that very often when students leave Israel or leave yeshiva, they hit culture shock. Sometimes it happens when you go back to your home territory and you start looking back at everything you accomplished and you ask yourself, was that for real? Maybe it was all a game. Especially if a person was used to going to Red Lobster and to Burger King, and suddenly he drives by the Burger King and he sees his old friend, the guy who always served him the chips, and he waves. And he says, why don't you come in for a free burger on me? And you're tempted, you say, nah, I don't do that anymore. But as you keep driving, you ask yourself, why not? Right? And then you start trying to reason, why not? But your heart is still at the Burger King. You know, there's the story about the Rebbe and the Chassid. They're walking by the river, and there's a woman bathing in the river. And the Rebbe keeps walking, and the Chassid's looking the other way. Two versions to the story. So 5 minutes later, the Chassid can't help it anymore. He says, Rebbe, I don't understand. I look that way. You look that way. So the first version, which was the one that's relevant to us, is the Rebbe says, yeah, but I left her in the river and you're still taking her with you. And you might have looked that way, but she's still on your mind. I kept walking. Okay, she's still there. So a person keeps going and he's taking the Burger King with him. His mind is still there and it's hard. That's one of the benefits. When you're in a yeshiva, you could think about life. If you go from the yeshiva to a neutral zone, you could think about life. If you go from yeshiva back to the old territory, it's very hard. The old territory is very comfortable. And then everything you did suddenly looks like, maybe. Maybe I was just taken. Maybe I was being a teenager. Idealistic, unrealistic. Wait, you want to judge it, so go to neutral territory. Go back to yeshiva for 3 months and then go, okay, look at both. Analyze it, but in a fair setting. But what very often happens is, no, you look at it from there, and from there, then. So yeah, we definitely have challenges. And I think that it's a hard line to draw between when is it imagination and when is it real. And that's why I asked Nachum, tell me what your criterion is. What do you want? Before, you know, before the question. Not that God will necessarily give us what we want, but we very often don't define it for ourselves, and then we fail to see it, like you're saying. But again, that I didn't want to go there if he wasn't pushing me there. I'm very scared of that, because I think the line between imagination and the real world is a hard one to define. Okay. We were in the parasha, believe it or not. We were, and we were discussing the fact that it's easy to seduce, and we were discussing Yosef in the prison, and we were discussing Yosef dealing with the fact that he did what was right, and then what turned out was wrong, and that in life, things don't exactly work the way we expect. We like to think we can corner God, And the Tanakh repeatedly teaches us that no, you're going to do what's right, and that does not mean you will understand the outcome. In hindsight, we look at the broad picture, we understand, okay, God was leading us a whole story here that would lead to many important results. But when you're in the story, when you're the puppet in the play, you don't exactly understand all the strings that are being pulled. And again, Yosef is faithful and honest. And he interprets the dream, and we have a tradition that a dream goes after its interpretation. I want to leave you with food for thought. Why is it that from Yaakov Avinu to the end of the book of Bereishis, we're going to be busy with dreams?
With what?
Dreams. From Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov leaves Canaan. He sees the ladder. He's in Laban's house. He sees another dream. He comes back. Yosef starts having dreams. Now the butler and the baker have dreams. Then Paro's going to have a dream. Why? Food for thought. Okay. Think about it. So our tradition is that the dream goes after its interpretation. Yosef interprets this one's dream that he will be reinstated, that one's dream that he will be executed. His interpretation comes true. And he asks the butler, just remember me when you get out. And the butler hates Yosef, and he forgets him. And perhaps we should just mention one very uncomfortable thought, but one that's a recurring theme in most people's lives. When you do someone a favor, there is a tendency that the person will hate you. Just as we find the butler hated Yosef. No one likes to owe a favor. And specifically, the greater the favor you do for someone, the greater their tendency to find a reason to hate you. And this reaches extremities. I mean, this reaches points where people can raise an orphan, and the orphan will afterwards sue them and be out to kill them. This can be a person donates a car to his friend, and the friend won't talk to him anymore because of all the problems he has with the car. Stop. Wait a second. Did he owe you anything? He gave you the car for free. In life, unfortunately, you will encounter this. There's a famous response in which one rabbi writes, I don't know why he hates me so much. I haven't done him any favors. There's this tendency. Man does not like to owe. And one of the ways we contend with that is that when we do owe someone something, we have a tendency to find serious flaws and serious reasons to have issue with them. And the example of that is the butler. It's interesting that Chazal call him wicked for doing this.
Is something missing in this explanation? I mean, Yaakov do a lot of good things to Yosef. Doesn't mean that Yosef hates Yaakov.
Oh, pious people overcome that tendency.
Oh,
a person can overcome it. Look, like you said, Yosef doesn't hate his father. You have a lot of people who you see, on the contrary, Moshe Rabbeinu has appreciation for the sand. He has appreciation for the Nile. The greater a person, the more he can express appreciation. That's true. But we have to realize there is that weakness. It's something to overcome. There is that tendency within a person.
Otherwise, you don't have nobody.
Okay. We can overcome it, and we should overcome it. That's true. Right? Tov.